Hello everyone and welcome to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and with me here in the studio is my friend and colleague, Niklas Sävås. Today we have the great pleasure of speaking with Brett Gardner. Brett is an investment analyst at the US-based investment partnership, The Serene Group, and he is soon to be a published author. So Niklas, which book will we discuss?
So the focus of our conversation today is Brett's upcoming book, Buffett's Early Investments, where he has uncovered a few of Buffett's investments in the 50s and 60s that until now have been rather unknown. While many have read about Buffett's investments in companies such as See's Candies and Geico, few have read about his investments in companies such as Philadelphia and Reading and Marshall Wells.
And what do you think about the book?
I think for investors such as myself that mostly focus on microcaps, some of the investments depicted in the book are more relevant than the investments we hear Buffett do today. And I think it's a really refreshing read with lots of insights. And I think many of our listeners will benefit from learning about how Buffett did his research at the time and why he decided to do the investments he did.
Buffett's Early Investments will be published by Harriman House in November 2024. And we are delighted to discuss it with the author today. Here comes our conversation with Brett Gardner. Hi, Brett, and welcome to Investing by the Books podcast.
Thank you.
It's great to have you on. And where are we reaching you today?
I'm in New York City today.
And in which office are we seeing you?
Oh, I'm actually in my apartment near Hell's Kitchen.
So to begin, for our listeners, maybe you can tell them about your background and how you got into investing.
Sure. So when I was around 16 years old, I accumulated a small amount of savings working a retail job. I didn't really know what to do with it. It was just kind of sitting in my bank account. And then I just pretty much started reading. I remember searching for investment books on Google and then picking up anything that was recommended. The first book I read was Burton McKeel's A Random Walk Down Wall Street. The book actually argues for the efficient market hypothesis. I remember reading it when I was a teenager and thinking that was kind of like silly. Kind of an arrogant teenager. Now I'm just an arrogant adult. So that part never changed. Then I quickly got to like the value classics and the Buffett classics specifically. I remember the first one I read was the Roger Lowenstein biography, The Making of an American Capitalist. I was kind of hooked since then. I quickly got to the Berkshire Letters, The Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis. I didn't really understand it all because I was only like 16 or 17 when I first read it. And then Alice Schroeder's The Snowball came out right around this period. And I obviously devoured that the second I got my hands on it. And I don't remember choosing to be a value investor necessarily. I just remember being a value investor. The philosophy always made sense to me. Buying things for less than they're worth just added up. I was just kind of a cheap, thrifty person, so value investing made sense. And I started investing personally when I was in high school in around 2008, 2009, which is right when the world was kind of going to hell. I didn't have the situational awareness at the time to realize the gravity of the situation. I remember running like NetNet screens and just seeing like a ton of names. As I'm sure your listeners know, NetNet is a stock selling for less than their net current asset value, which is current assets minus all liabilities. So Ben Graham used that as a proxy for liquidation value, and he usually bought a bunch of them, like in Graham Newman, he owned almost 100 of them. So he took a pretty diversified approach. And I was running these screens, I remember seeing hundreds of them as well. I didn't realize how rare that investing environment actually was, where almost like everything was trading cheaply. And that's kind of how I got my first start into investing.
And today we will speak about your book, Buffett's Early Investments, that is about to be released. What caused you to write it?
So I actually started researching the book way before I decided to write it. So about a decade ago, I was a few years into my professional investment career. For context, I'm 33 right now. I was having a lot of trouble finding these cheap stocks that Buffett seemed to find with ease. I would reread Snowball every couple of years, which touched on some of the bargains Buffett found when he was in his 20s and 30s. And I remember being struck at how obviously cheap these stocks were. There were stocks trading at less than their net current asset value, single-digit PE ratios, some at one times earnings. I kind of just walked away thinking like Buffett had it much easier than I did. And then investing back in the 50s, 60s, and even 70s was just simpler. And I started going to the New York Public Library's Business Library to read the old annual reports. I was kind of generally interested in corporate history and read like Coke annual reports from the 20s and 30s and AT&T reports from throughout the 20th century. But then I started kind of gravitating more towards Buffett-focused investments. And I'd go to the basement of the library and read them on like Microcard and Microfiche. And over kind of months of research, I realized that these seemingly insanely cheap stocks actually didn't really do all that well. Or I realized that there were significant risks to them that Buffett had to research, analyze, and get comfortable with in order to allocate capital to the idea. And the more I kept digging, the more interesting I thought the story was. I thought the popular narrative that Buffett was shooting fish in a barrel when he started out was just false. And it's kind of funny. I think that Buffett and Charlie Munger themselves have even perpetuated that myth to a degree, because they talk about how much easier it was when they were starting out. And Charlie Munger a few years ago said all Buffett had to do was go through lists of liquid securities and slowly buy them, and he can get these ridiculous bargains. And it's total oversimplification. I read the same Moody's manuals that Buffett read when he was 20, 21, 22, and there were a lot of cheap stocks, and not all of them did well. So this idea that it was way more difficult than people perceive kind of stuck in my mind for a couple of years. And then there were two investments that really made me feel like I had an obligation to write and share what I knew. The first was Philadelphia and Reading, which was 24-year-old Warren Buffett's largest investment at the end of 1954. This was NetNet. It was an anthracite coal company that was making almost no money and turned into a 20-bagger. I thought the how and the why were so interesting, and more importantly, the lessons Buffett took from that investment and carried forward throughout his career were so powerful that I felt obligated to bring the knowledge into the public sphere to expand the evidence base surrounding Buffett's early career. And then the second company, which I know I'm sure we'll talk about, was Walt Disney Productions, a very well-known company today and even back then, actually. Buffett made it about nearly a 10% position in 1966. And he's talked about this investment multiple times throughout his career at annual meetings and his investor letters. But to me, he left out the most important part of that investment and the most interesting part. I thought these investments were way more interesting than people knew, and I felt obligated to write about them. I thought the bar for researching a book was way higher than my weekend trips to the library basement. So I started ordering books on the companies, started ordering old periodicals such as Fortune's, Forbes, started reading old newspapers. So I really wanted to understand the companies, and the context surrounding them and the industries.
Really interesting, and we will speak more about the companies you mentioned later. And of course, we're really happy that you embarked on this journey to dig into all of these unknown stories about Buffett, which is a hero for many listeners of our podcast. And in the book, you list 10 of Buffett's investments that he made during the early stages of his career, and you present quite a thorough background of the companies and also try to distill Buffett's thought process. How did you select these 10 investments that you included in the book?
Sure. So there were three broad criteria that I used to choose the 10 investments. The first was my ability to secure proper documents for the investments, rather Moody's manuals or annual reports or anything kind of relevant to the investment. The second filter was whether I thought my research was differentiated enough. I didn't want to write about investments that were well-known and well-covered. For example, Buffett in his partnership letters wrote quite a bit about Sanborn Mapp or Dempster Mills, and I didn't really think I could add a whole lot of value to that. Alice Schroeder in The Snowball also covers investments like Rockwood really well, and I don't think I can do better than what she did on those. So the second filter was just whether I thought I could do a good job and give people something new. And the third criteria was whether I thought that the investment was just interesting enough. For example, I start the book off with three net nets that really didn't do that well with Buffett. In the original manuscript, I had a fourth, and I thought it was kind of overkill to have 4 out of 10 of the investments be net nets that didn't work out well. I think I made my point. because I try to, within the book, use the 10 case studies to tell a narrative about Warren Buffett and how he developed as an investor.
Out of curiosity also, I mean, you chose these 10 investments, and it's around 20 years you cover in total, right? From the first to the last. And how many companies did you find that he actually owned during this time? I mean, how many did you have to choose from?
Oh, I think it was about 30 or 40, maybe even more. But I'd say that there were about 12 to 15 that I researched in some depth and thought about writing about. I had two draft chapters that I entirely discarded, so I did some pretty deep research on those. Overall, probably around 30 or 40.
And on your quest for information, now when we record this, Buffett himself is 94 years old and alive and doing well. Was he involved somehow in the process?
I'd argue he was involved the whole process since the book is about his life. But no, he wasn't directly involved. I actually wrote to him about 6 or 7 years ago before I decided writing about this 1952 memo that he wrote on Cleveland Worston Mills, which I write about. His assistant wrote back saying that the document was in dead storage and they couldn't retrieve it, but to check security analysis, and sure enough, it was in there. And then when I actually decided to start writing, I wrote to him informing him of the project and asked for an interview. He politely declined, but sent along an email wishing me well.
And another big legend that many of our listeners are familiar with is Peter Kaufman, who wrote Poor Charlie's Almanac. He's also seemed to have been influential in your work. What was his role in this?
Yeah, so for listeners who don't know Peter Kaufman, he's the chairman and CEO of Glen Eyre and the author of Poor Charlie's Almanac, which everyone should go buy and read. So during the course of my writing, I was introduced to Peter, and he invited me out to meet him, tour Glen Eyre, and meet Charlie for lunch. It was an extraordinarily generous gesture on both Peter and Charlie's part.
And how was it meeting Charlie?
It was amazing. I went to Charlie's house 2 months prior to his passing and had lunch with him along with a few other people. I was at his home for about 3.5 hours. I had about 40 minutes alone with him. He was extraordinarily funny. He was even funnier than he was at the annual meetings. He talked about a variety of topics and also answered some questions related to the investments I was writing about that he's involved in. There were two things that really stuck out at me. First, he mentioned a couple of times how painful the years 1973 and 1974 were to him when he was down 32% in 73 and down more than 31% in 74. He mentioned that he knew he was right on the investments that he had in his partnership. That he knew that the stock's worth way more than what they were selling for in the market, but he had difficulty communicating that to partners, and he really showed that he shared his partner's pain. Now, he had a strong fiduciary gene that came throughout the conversation. The second was that he mentioned how getting off to a fast start was critical to success. This came up because it was in the context of British Columbia Power, which I write about, which Buffett made about an 11% position in his partnership, but Charlie put his entire partnership into that investment, and it was a big winner for Charlie and helped him go up 30% in his first year running his fund. I think, you know, we all know we need to analyze investors over longer time horizons, but Charlie was able to get almost lucky in a way to get off to a fast start and find such good opportunities on day one. Charlie and Warren are the only two investors I sort of really remain in awe of, and meeting Charlie lives up to expectations, and I'm very lucky to have met him. One thing I want to point out about Charlie is how he persevered through some immense personal challenges. Like, we all focus on his tremendous investment success, his genius, and his humor. But when he was around my age, he had just lost his son to leukemia, was divorced and broke, and he went from those lows to what he became. I think one of the things that people don't appreciate enough about both Warren and Charlie is that they were just like tremendously gritty individuals. And I think that's something I really admire about both of them.
And I think on the last topic, I think the book Damn Right is really good to get some more personal details about Charlie. And of course, thanks for sharing that story. And now we want to turn back the clock a bit and talk about the 1950s and actually start with the first story in your book, Buffett's investment in Marshall Wells. So can you tell our listeners about what type of business was Marshall Wells?
Of course. Marshall Wells was a hardware wholesaler, and they were actually the largest hardware wholesaler in North America and probably the world. The company sold hardware goods, tools, electric appliances, paint, sporting goods, and more into the northwestern states of the United States and into Canada, as well as Alaska, which wasn't a state until 1959. And Marshall Wells had three customers. They did not operate stores themselves. So they had stores under what they call the Marshall Wells store plan, which is somewhat similar to a franchise agreement, where Marshall Wells helped set up the stores and furnish inventory. And they also sold to industrial customers and independent retailers. They also had some subsidiaries that manufactured products, but at its core, it was a wholesaler.
And you mentioned this was a large, pretty large company. How big was it in terms of, I mean, compared to other firms in indexes or so?
So Marshall Wells was big enough that when the Fortune 500 list of largest companies came out a few years later, it was in the top 400. So it was a pretty big company and fairly well known.
And Buffett actually invested 25% of his net worth in the stock. Why do you think he was willing to take that big bet?
Because the stock looked crazy cheap. When he bought the stock in 1950, it sold for less than 2x EV to EBIT, PE ratio of less than 6x, and only 0.6x net current asset value. So it looked crazy cheap. And then it had been profitable, I believe, for 17 years in a row. So it wasn't a net losing money. It was a profitable company. It was largely growing. And it's important to remember, so Buffett was 20 years old when he made this investment, and he had kind of just read Intelligent Investor, which is really focused on the quantitative aspects of an investment, and the stock was just screaming cheap.
And tell us, how did the story play out?
So Warren actually went to the annual meeting, which was held in Jersey City. So at the time, he was a student at Columbia, but he hadn't yet taken Ben Graham's class. So he asked David Dodd, who was co-author of Security Analysis, if he could skip class to go to the meeting. Dodd approved, and Buffett went with a friend. While at the meeting, Buffett met a couple of very interesting people. He met Walter Schloss, who at the time worked for Ben Graham and later started his own very successful fund. And then he also met Lewis Green, who was a partner at an investment firm, friend of Ben Graham's. They served on boards together, invested in similar companies. And Green actually invited Buffett out to lunch. And while at the lunch, Green asked Buffett why he bought Marshall Wells. Buffett said that he bought it because Ben Graham bought it. This is not true. Buffett had done his own research and investigated the company himself. And Green was kind of like disgusted at this answer. And he said, strike one, implying that Buffett had made a big mistake. And a few years later, when Ben Graham was closing down his partnership and Buffett was starting his own partnership, Buffett was trying to raise money in New York. And Green was at the final meeting of Graham Newman and asked why Ben Graham didn't develop any talent. And he's quoted in the Snowball as saying something to the effect of, all they have is this Warren Buffett who would ride with him. It's pretty funny. On the investment itself, Buffett flipped the stock fairly quickly at like a 1% loss or so. And I think that he did it because when he went to the annual meeting, he was fairly disgusted by the behavior of management, where they had like no respect for shareholders. Like, Walter Schloss was asking some tough questions and management brushed him off. I think Buffett saw that and thought that the way Marshall Wells operated was inconsistent with how he viewed business. And so he quickly sold. And what kind of really got me thinking was the stock, which traded so cheaply, did not do that well even after Buffett sold. So for context, Buffett was putting up 75% year in 1951, 145% year in 1954, and then the 29.5% compounded when he ran the partnership. Marshall Wells, over the next 5 or 6 years before he was taken over, compounded capital for shareholders at about 15%, which is a good return, obviously, but it wasn't Buffett good. You know, investment like this sort of raised questions in my mind about whether the narrative that Buffett had it much easier really made sense.
Great takeaways from that story. And another investment, you mentioned it in the beginning of this conversation, was Philadelphia and Reading, or in short, PNR, which he also invested in the early 1950s before he set up his partnership. So what type of business was PNR?
Philadelphia and Reading was an anthracite coal company, which used to be used to heat homes. Anthracite coal used to be super important in the United States. It contributed almost 20% of America's energy output at its peak in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But by the 1950s, it was declining rapidly and clearly on the cusp of going away.
And how big of a position did Buffett take in PNR?
Buffett made about a 35% position in his portfolio by the end of 1954. It was his biggest position at the time.
And what do you think attracted him to the business, or rather the investment case?
So first it was a net-net. It was barely profitable. I think it earned like $100,000 when Buffett first bought it. But the most important factor was that Ben Graham was on the board. Buffett was working at Graham Newman, Ben Graham's fund at the time, and he was kind of sitting in the office hearing Graham talk about it, and that was probably the most important driver in Buffett making it a big investment.
And for us, focusing a lot on what today is often called serial acquirers, we find many similarities to the success stories in Sweden. Can you tell us a little bit about what happened during PNR's time? I mean, from the start, you mentioned that it was purely an anthracite coal company, but things happened after that. Tell us the story.
Yeah. So Ben Graham joined the board in 1952 after he bought the stock. He was actually thinking about selling it, but was persuaded to keep the stock by Mickey Newman, who was his partner, Jerome Newman's son. And then Mickey sort of really led the way in transforming the company. The first acquisition they made was Union Underwear, which Buffett has talked about in the Berkshire letters. They paid about $15 million for a company that had $3 million of pre-tax earnings. Corporate tax rates were around 50% then, so it's not as cheap as it would be at current tax rates. But there are a couple of interesting parts of this investment. First, they financed it with non-interest-bearing notes payable from earnings in excess of $1 million. They also had this huge tax shield, so the pre-tax profits would largely fall to the bottom line. And Union was sort of a point of contention with the other directors. The Graham contingent didn't have full control of the board at this point, and the other directors kind of looked at Mickey and thought he was just basically trying to steal the company and run it himself, which he was. So they kind of pushed back on Union Underwear, and after that, Graham kind of got pissed and took over the board, added some friends, including Lewis Green from the Marshall Wells incident. And then Mickey became president and kept making acquisitions. Next one he made was Acme Boots, which was a similarly cheap buy. And then over the next about 15 years, he just kept acquiring companies, buying some public stakes in companies, and transforming PNR from a dying anthracite coal company to a sprawling conglomerate.
And I think a few things stand out, which are quite interesting details in this story that we hear from many of the successful serial acquirers and conglomerates today. And one is that they wanted the CEO of the acquired companies to stay after they got bought. And they also preferred to source deals internally from their own network and not go through brokers. And I also think it was really interesting how they structured the management compensation. Can you talk about how PNR worked with incentives for its subsidiaries?
Sure. So PNR typically gave management earnouts. So there was usually a threshold of earnings that they had to hit, and then management will get a cut of profits above that. And I think you touched on something very important, that Mickey Newman used his network to find ideas. So like in Union Underwear, for example, the head of the company was trying to sell the company for some years. He was getting older and wanted to kind of plan for the estate. And he would go to Wall Street and they would rather dissuade him to from trying to take the company public or introduce him to some buyers he didn't really trust. So part of the reason why P&R was able to get a bargain was because of Mickey Newman's relationship with the head of Union Underwear. And for those who don't know, Union Underwear was a licensee of Fruit of the Loom, which Berkshire acquired in 2001.
Do you have any other takeaways from the P&R case?
Yeah, so P&R to me is my favorite chapter in the book, is my favorite researching and writing, because I think you can draw a straight line from Philadelphia and Reading to Berkshire Hathaway. And what I mean by that is Buffett saw up close the power of total control, all the ways an intelligent investor can maximize value, not when he's influencing management, but becomes management. I mean, you look at P&R, they were a 19th century industrial company in the midst of an irreversible secular decline, trading at a cheap valuation. There's a fight for control, partial liquidation of inventory to raise cash, and there was a reallocation of capital towards new and better businesses. That is what Buffett did with Berkshire Hathaway. I think that when Buffett was 24 years old and looking at this and seeing all the ways Mickey Newman created value, he had in the back of his mind that he was going to do this someday. He's never really said that outright, but I think he realized the power of a permanent capital vehicle and the power of controlling the capital himself. I mean, throughout the Berkshire letters and at the annual meeting, he talks about the benefits of him controlling the capital. And I think he learned those lessons from Philadelphia and Reading.
We see the result now, 70 years later.
Yeah, he did okay.
Definitely. And we, of course, encourage all of our listeners to read the book and buy it so you can really dig deep into the different stories. And we can't cover all of the stories here, but we would like to bring up a third case. And that's also one that you mentioned in the beginning, which is Disney. And this is a company, of course, everyone is familiar with today. But when Buffett looked at it in 1966, the situation was very different. So what position did Disney have at that time?
Disney was still a very famous company at the time. So when Disneyland opened in 1955, around 90 million people watched the ABC broadcast of the park's debut. And the U.S. population was only around 160 million people at the time. So more than half the country was tuned in. Disney also was well known for the shorts through the 30s, Snow White, and had won numerous awards in animation over the decades. So the company was well known, but it was not considered a major studio at the time, despite earning more profits than almost every other studio. The company released fewer films than its other competitors. Its strategy was focused on making a few great films rather than having a wide portfolio of films that they didn't invest that much into. The other important thing is that the Florida park wasn't built yet either. So you had the California park, you had the film studio, and that was sort of it. So Buffett was initially drawn in because the valuation was pretty cheap. It was trading at about a 7x PE ratio, less than around 4x EBIT. So it looked cheap. And the concern was that the company was over-earning. So the company was in the midst of rolling out Mary Poppins worldwide, so produced record profits in 1965. And when Buffett invested in 1966, it was still rolling out across the globe, but people kind of looked at the company and thought this would stop eventually. I mean, Mary Poppins was an incredibly successful film. It was like the fourth highest grossing film of all time. You can't count on another film that successful. But I think that what really drew Buffett in was that the company had this enormous hidden asset value through the film library. So the company had made hundreds of films and shorts over the years, and it was mostly written down to zero on the balance sheet. But Buffett knew it was enormously profitable. There were transaction comps at the time from other studios that indicated that you could sell your library for a lot of money. And Disney also re-released films usually every like 7 years or so, which helped them earn a lot of net income in years where the studio was otherwise struggling. So this was like, this wasn't a theoretical idea of this hidden massive value. It was something proven out over time. And while the comps aren't perfect, I think Buffett probably thought that the library itself, excluding all other assets and future movies, was worth the $80 million that the company was selling for in the market. And then once he kind of had that downside protection, he saw that there was Walt Disney World, which was had real asset value, was profitable and growing. He had the land for the Florida park, and he also had Walt Disney running it. And these factors made him pull the trigger and invest almost 10% of the partnership into Disney stock. And importantly, I don't think Buffett had a point intrinsic value in mind. I think he had a range, and he kind of looked at the stock and he asked, so like, what's it worth? And then he looked at the market price. He's like, well, more than that. And that was kind of it. He didn't necessarily know for sure it was worth $300 or $400 million, but he's like, it's worth a lot more than 80.
And you mentioned the CEO and founder, Walt Disney. And according to what I got from your case is that he was not really the regular CEO in several aspects. Can you talk about how he ran the company?
Of course. So Walt was actually not the CEO. His title was executive producer in charge of all production. His brother, Roy, was the president and would gain the title of CEO in 1966 after Walt's passing. However, Walt Disney Productions was a company ran by Walt Disney. Roy was kind of a counterbalancing force, focused more on the financials and make sure the company had the cash to fund Walt's expeditions. But he also offered some pushback. For example, he was a skeptic of Disneyland before Walt secured initial funding from other sources. Walt was very unfriendly toward shareholders. He did not care about shareholder profits. He had no problem admitting that. And the most interesting part of the story, in my view, is that he had some related party dealings with Walt Disney Productions that raised some red flags. He had an outside company that earned fees from Walt Disney Productions, licensing name. He earned some income from the monorail at Disneyland, and he had rights to certain movies that Disney produced. So despite Walt Disney Productions making the movie, Walt could still invest alongside Walt Disney Productions in order to earn income from those movies. Like, I think he earned more than $1 million in Mary Poppins, for example, in this outside company. It was really bad corporate governance. And the corporate governance was a threshold question that Buffett had to overcome in order to invest capital in the idea. So he went out to California, met Walt, and then bought the stock. I think he realized that Walt was a genius and not necessarily a bad guy. So Walt needs to be analyzed in the context of his history, where he had his intellectual property stolen from him when he had Oswald the Rabbit. He kind of grew up poor and had a rough childhood. And these factors probably made Walt a little more distrusting of even his own company. And I think Buffett looked at that and was like, okay, Walt's not a bad guy. I don't have to like this. But I also think this was a limiting factor in how big Buffett sized the position. So he made it about an 8.5% position in the partnership, while he made others like Dempster Mills and Sanborn Mapp worth north of 25% of partnership assets. And a few years prior to the Disney investment, made American Express 40% of the partnership's assets. I suspect he limited his position partially due to the corporate governance risk, and also because of the movie industry's inherent volatility.
And you also think, I mean, the governance question was also a reason for why he didn't hold on to the stock for longer. Because tell us, I mean, from when he bought, what happened after? I mean, how long did he own it, and how did it go?
Sure. So the stock shot up 50% within a year, and Buffett sold it. But during this time period, Walt unfortunately passed away. And I think that Buffett sold the stock because Walt Disney Productions with Walt was an entirely different animal than Walt Disney Productions without him. Also, because the stock increased, the downside protection wasn't really there. So in the book, I kind of lay out some of the risks related to Walt Disney. And one of the key ones is the risk that Walt Disney passes away. And that came to fruition. And I think that contributed to Buffett selling the stock quicker than he might have otherwise. But another kind of interesting anecdote is Buffett has talked about what a mistake it was selling Disney, but Berkshire has actually compounded capital at higher rates than Disney stock did. So I actually don't think it was a mistake at all.
Thanks for all the interesting takes on these three companies. And a sort of broader question I have is we're used to hear about Buffett's focus on businesses that prosper from some kind of moat, but a majority of the businesses depicted in the book, in my view, don't have an obvious moat, but was instead really cheap. And Buffett has said multiple times that if he had to start over with $1 million, he would be able to compound the capital at 50% per year. The question is, how do you think he would do that?
So I get asked this question a lot, whether I think he could do it, and I do. I think Warren Buffett can compound $1 million at 50%. Now, I can't speak for Buffett, obviously, but I suspect that he would do it the same way he did in the 50s before he started his partnership. He always says that he starts with the A's, meaning he goes through literally every company, and he's looking for little arbitrage opportunities or wrinkles in the market. I think that one of the things that is underappreciated about Buffett is what a sophisticated financial market participant he is, where he's able to kind of hunt out these like weird, intricate, cheap situations that allow him to make a lot of money. And I think you'd kind of be more focused on those opportunities than good businesses. The way I would kind of phrase it is I think he'd be looking for what are today known as like special situations more than the long-term investments. And he'd probably be more focused in the small and nano cap type markets than he is today. One of the things I would point out is you really only need one or two ideas like this a year to drive these spectacular returns. I think he would continue to be tremendously concentrated. You know, I mean, back in the partnership, he was often taking 25-30% positions, and I think he would be similar if he were starting out today.
One thing I take with me from this is that, I mean, when he speaks now, he often speaks about it's better to buy sort of better businesses. But as you say, I mean, he wouldn't necessarily do that if he started over. And many of the investors that listen to Buffett probably have sort of below the $1 million fortune. So why do you think he says that? Is that because it's really hard to do it the way Buffett did? And I mean, he is a really special investor, of course.
Yeah. So another interesting note from my meeting with Charlie is when I asked him what he would be doing if he were starting out, he said, I'd always be looking for the better business. And I thought there was a lot of interesting stuff in there. So looking for the better business doesn't mean you're going to find and buy the better business, right? These great businesses are, I think, rarer than people think. And secondly, they're seldom cheap enough to buy. So I think the bigger price to value discrepancies are going to be found in more hairy situations or smaller situations. And I think that's the type of stuff Buffett would be focused on, because I think that the price to value gap in those types of companies is likely to be greater and more obvious than in bigger companies with longer term track records and fairly profitable companies.
I think this is a good segue into your current role. You are an investment analyst at Disserine Group. Please tell us about the firm.
Disserine is a private investment partnership that invests globally on behalf of several philosophically aligned investors pursuing a fundamental contrarian long-term value investing philosophy. The firm invests in businesses protected by either structural barriers to entry or hard assets when they are out of favor at prices offering significant margins of safety. Disserine is run by Sushen Tan, who actually wrote the foreword to my book. I'd actually interned at Disserine in 2011-2012, so I was familiar with the firm when I rejoined in April 2024. Some investments that were in the portfolio when I interned were still there when I joined as an analyst, so the firm is truly long-term.
And it was a really nice foreword as well. And in your role as an analyst now, what businesses are you focusing on?
I'm a generalist, so I study anything. And DiscRing has a truly unconstrained global mandate, so I can look at anything anywhere.
So when it comes to research, which of Buffett's methods are you using?
Philosophically, I believe that DiscRing pursues a value investing strategy that is inspired by and is based on similar core principles as Buffett's. But more tangibly, DiscRing does an enormous amount of empirical research and scuttlebutt calls. Buffett did so much creative gumshoe research throughout his career that people don't properly appreciate. I think that DiscRing genuinely tries to do the type of work that allows us to develop differentiated views on businesses.
And so this is a book podcast. We like to wrap up with a few questions on writing and reading. So do you have one or two less known titles that you think we and our listeners here should read to improve as investors?
Of course, I'm concerned that your readers will know these two, but I think these are largely unappreciated. The first is The Halo Effect by Phil Rosenzweig. I read this first in college and kind of reread it every couple of years. Very thought-provoking book. He lays out the mistakes found in business journalism, and he kind of destroys the narrative-based lens through which the media talks about businesses. It's a very rigorous book, in my view. It's a quick read, too. It's a thoughtful framework that helps you think about how the narratives on most businesses are wrong and why they're wrong. The second book is called Good Strategy, Bad Strategy by Richard Rumel. It's a very useful framework for analyzing corporate strategy. He spends a lot of time talking about what companies do wrong and how to do it right. I think that was younger as an investor. I didn't always have a good handle on how to handicap corporate strategy. The book gives you a really good framework for how to analyze it and think about it. And also what I like about it is says that there's like no quick solution. Strategy is supposed to be hard. If it was obvious, people would already be doing it. And he also recently released The Crux, which is sort of a follow-up to Good Strategy, Bad Strategy. And I think it's quite good as well.
Good advice. And how much are you reading these days when it comes to books versus annual reports, for example?
I'm probably pretty skewed to annual reports right now. I'm probably, unfortunately, down to like a book a week or so. So, and reading more annuals than that. So,
that's a lot of reading. I think that's more than most people do these days. And what type of books are attracting you these days?
So I read a lot of biographies. I think I'm rereading like Titan right now. I also like reading psychology books. I've probably focused less on reading like the value investing classics. I probably shouldn't say this, but I just wrote a book that's very focused on value investing, but I think that beyond reading a few of them, people should actually focus more on reading annual reports than reading the next value investing book. I'm also reading a book on Disneyland right now that I didn't actually read when I was writing, which is fun.
And I also think, I mean, even though your book is an investing book, it's not really a traditional investing book. It's more, for me, it's read sort of as a biography and really fun read. So I really like the format that you have in the book.
Yeah, and there are many books on Buffett, but we definitely think this one stands out and worth a read.
Thank you. So one thing I'd say is when I was initially writing the book, it was going to be very equity research report type writing. And I sent it to a well-known investor who called me up and is like, you got to work on your writing. So I hired a couple writing coaches. And I think it's much better than it would have had been. I was actually rereading the book this weekend. I feel like I developed a lot as a writer. Hopefully readers do too. But some of the earlier chapters aren't as good as the later chapters, in my view. But
I think they are all good and they all fit very well together. So when it comes to writing, you are now publishing your first book. Do you have any ambitions to write another one?
No, because I don't think I have anything else interesting to say. More seriously, I never really wanted to be a writer. I kind of felt like my research forced me to be a writer. I think I would do it if there was another topic where I thought I could offer a unique perspective. For example, I was always interested in like Charlie Munger's partnership, but I actually don't have a like, great amount of detail on that. If there ever became like documents available where I thought I could do good work on that or somebody else, I'd consider it. But I'd say that I'm probably more focused on developing as an investor and an analyst. So the bar is even higher to allocate additional time to another book.
Understandable. Brett Gardner, thank you so much for coming on Investing by the Books podcast to talk about your new book, Buffett's Early Investments. Do you have something more you want to add here before we finish up?
Sure. First, I want to thank everyone for listening and hopefully reading. And I want to thank both of you for being very generous and having me on. Second, I hope people find my book motivating. Like, I hope they learn something from the companies as well. But I find it fairly inspirational to see young Warren Buffett stumble and continue to persevere and grow. I write about this in the conclusion a little bit, but I actually hate when people call him the Oracle of Omaha, because it kind of like deifies him, puts him on this like high ground when he was, one, he was blessed with a very high IQ, but more importantly, he was a tenacious, gritty person who fought to learn about business in any way he could. And I hope my book shows that. And I hope people, whether they're investors or not, take those lessons and apply them to whatever vocation they should choose.
Well put. And lastly, where can our audience follow you and your work?
They can find me on X at Brett Gardner, BRETTGARDNER _10, just 10. I'm also on LinkedIn. People should feel free to reach out to me. They can also email me at Brett@BuffettsEarlyInvestments.com. Both Brett and Buffett are with 2 T's. And Buffett's Early Investments is just like the book title, but with no apostrophe. You know, one of the fun things about writing this book is getting to know people who are interested in the same stuff. My book isn't even out yet, and people have reached out to me over the past year and a half expressing interest in it and telling me things I didn't know about Buffett or this part of his career, and I really enjoy that, so love to hear from people.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Brett.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Investing by the Books, a podcast by Redeye. Follow us on Twitter at @IB_redeye and email us at ib.podcast@redeye.se. To improve, we'd love to hear your feedback, so please rate and review us. Notice that the content in this podcast is not and shall not be construed as investment advice. This information is meant to be informative and for general purposes only. For full disclaimer, visit redeye.se. I'm your host, Eddie Palmian, and until next time, I sincerely wish you the best of luck on your journey through life and investing.